Hi everyone. So thanks for joining me today. I am delighted that I am joined by Professor Leslie Thomas KC, who will speak to me from Antigua about his career and his journey. So just by way of introduction, Leslie is a leading expert in claims against the police and other public authorities and claims against corporate bodies with expertise across the full spectrum of civil wrongs, civil litigation, human rights, data and privacy claims. He is an expert in all aspects of inquests and public inquiries, having represented many bereaved families in particular where there has been abuse of state or corporate power. Leslie acts for claimants in judicial review proceedings and other public law proceedings. He regularly acts for clients in the Caribbean region on constitutional law challenges and has represented claimants in clinical negligence and personal injury for the last 20 years. Leslie is ranked in Band 1 in the Chambers and Partners in Tier 1 in Legal 500 for inquests and public inquiries and police law. He is also ranked by Chambers and Partners and Legal 500 in Civil Liberties and Human Rights. Leslie is currently Professor of Law at Gresham College, delivering his lecture series, Hard Choices, The Law's Struggle with Ethical Dilemmas. Now, with that introduction, we are really scratching the surface of Leslie's extraordinary portfolio of work, which we will be looking at today, not covering even close to all of his cases, but you will be familiar with a lot of his work. And of course, we talk about his book in some detail. So thank you again for joining me and I hope you enjoy this recording. Professor Leslie Thomas, I'm glad to have you share your time with us today to discuss about, you know, your cases, your journey into law, and I suppose that's where we'll start, right back to where it all began in terms of your career. What led you into the law?
Well, I was always quite argumentative at school and I think I was real thorn in the side of many of my teachers, not in a horrible way, but in a way that I would never accept things. I would always be questioning their rules. And I can see that if you're a busy teacher in a comprehensive school with 35 kids trying to keep control of the class, having to explain every single thing because you have one kid at the back who can be a bit annoying, can be quite irritating, I suspect. But specifically what led me into law, I think the one key event that I remember is being stopped by the police. I was on my way home from school. I would have been about 14 at the time, would have been in a school uniform, had a school blazer on and had a backpack on my back. And I was walking near my home on a busy high street, and all of a sudden, the SPG group, that's the special patrol group, which was the territorial police group that used to roam the streets of London, I think harassing and picking on black kids, pulled up alongside me, and four big burly white police officers jumped out and stopped me. And the conversation went something like this. Yes, officer, how can I help you? And one of the officers said, you look suspicious. And I don't know why I looked suspicious, apart from the fact that I was in a school uniform with a backpack on,
right,
and being a 14-year-old black kid. And then he said, then they went on to say that they wanted to search me. So I asked, why? Why were they wanting to search me? What had I done? And they said that I fitted the description, his words were, you fit the description of somebody who's committed a domestic burglary. He never told me how I fitted the description, so I can only assume that this domestic burglar must have been about 14 years old, a black kid in a school uniform, and with a backpack on. And then they proceeded to frisk me. Now, here's the thing. Back in 1980s London, growing up, you were very suspicious of the police, and particularly if they stopped you without any good reason. I don't think these officers had any particularly good reason to stop me. And one of the officers went to put his hand into my pocket, and I stopped him. And the reason why I stopped him, because back then, we were really worried about being planted.
Yeah.
You know, it was very easy for officers to put their hands in your pocket and pull their hand up and say, look what I found. And I, you know, called him out on that, and the conversation took a turn for the worse. You know, if you don't do what we say, you'll be down the station faster than you can think, Sonny. And, you know, it just got really hostile. And I never felt so humiliated. Mm. You know, there I was on my way home from school on a busy high street at about 4 p.m. in the afternoon, having my pockets turned out by police officers with everybody looking at me. And at that moment in time, I knew there and then that I wanted to be a lawyer. I didn't know what a barrister was. I just knew I wanted to hold these officers to account. Mm-hmm. And so what happened to me would not happen to other people. So that's the earliest memory that I can remember that I wanted to be to go into law.
So a really defining moment. And I guess I know that you started off in corporate law. Why was that? And then you kind of made the change over to more of a rights-based practice.
Yeah. So I went to university. Well, it was Polytechnic at the time. It was Kingston Poly, now Kingston University in Surrey. And I really excelled on my law degree. I think that's when I found myself and, you know, really enjoyed doing a law degree. Mm. And one of my professors thought, promising me, now I didn't know anybody in the law.
Yeah.
I didn't have a clue. I came from a comprehensive school. You know, my folks had nothing to do with law. My mum was a nurse. My dad was a technician for British Telecom, GPO as it then was called. And this professor said to me, look, Leslie, I think you'd be a really good barrister. I've got a friend who, you know, might be able to help you. And so I said, yeah, you know, great. I'll take all the help I can get. And he introduced me to a friend of his, and I'll never forget this man. You know, I remember him with absolute fondness, and he was such a kind soul. His name was Dave Richardson. And he was a commercial barrister. And I remember turning up, and I just thought I was just going to meet David. But I turned up, and he gave me a pupillage, a traineeship. And my law professor had arranged it all. Now, you know, it isn't very equal opportunities, but things weren't very equal opportunities back then. You know, it was, you know, jobs for the boys. And this old boys network, because my law professor and David knew each other from Cambridge, they gave, you know, they spoke, and my professor said, you know, you want to take on Leslie, I think he's got promise. And he did. And when I was with David, it was all commercial law, and it was a really, you know, deep dive in introduction for me into the world of commercial law. And whilst the training was absolutely brilliant, I hated it. I thought to myself, every day I used to go into work, you know, where are all the real people? Mm. But I didn't want to be, you know, ungrateful for the opportunity that I had been given. So I got my head down, worked hard, got a really good training. And every evening, right, I would, to ease my soul, I would volunteer at different law centres around London. So I was literally doing, you know, four law centres a week, a different one on a different night every week, just voluntary work. And that's where I met real people with real problems who needed my help. And I did a lot of social security law, you know, welfare benefits, landlord and tenant housing rights, and debt actions.
Yeah.
And it was while I was doing law centre work that I was introduced to police actions and people who had, you know, had got into trouble with the police, and I really enjoyed doing that.
Yeah.
So that's how I made the transition. And I've had a lot of luck in my life and being in the right place at the right time. One of the legal advice centres that I was working in of an evening as a volunteer was Liberty. as it now is. It was the National Council for Civil Liberties at the time. And when I was there, I met at one of their Christmas parties, a chap came over to me and started speaking to me. And it was Tony Gifford, Lord Gifford, who had been doing the Guildford for Birmingham City. You know, he was doing the miners' strike. And, you know, we got talking, and he just said to me, you seem interested in what you're doing. So I explained that I was working for Liberty as a volunteer in the evening. He said, what do you do in the day job? And I told him that I was a barrister, or I was a pupil at the time, in this commercial set. And he said, what are you doing that for? And he said, why don't you come along to and meet my chambers? I didn't know who he was. Yeah. I didn't know he was the head of the chambers. So I took him up in his office and I went there. And they interviewed me. They took me on. And this is Wellington Street. So, I really have been lucky. Mm-hmm. And then when I got to Wellington Street, there was no looking back, because I was introduced to some of the most progressive lawyers in the country doing amazing work. You know, this was now late 80s, early 90s. It was Thatcher's reign, Thatcher's government, and they had the poll tax. And I remember doing a load of poll tax and protester cases. And that was a real baptism of fire for me to go from commercial law straight into protest work.
Yeah. And I suppose just looking at the climate within which you started practicing, so you said they're the late 80s, early 90s during Thatcher's reign, and we're all familiar with what was happening at that time as well, a very difficult time in history. But I'm wondering, as a young black man entering into the legal profession, you know, how did you find it? Did you mentioned the incident that happened to you when you were 14, a young boy, and that kind of paved your way into law. Was it difficult back then, and have things progressed, I suppose?
Okay, so let me come to the last question. Have things progressed? Yeah, they have progressed. It's not the same. Mm-hmm. There's still a long way, I think, the professions can go. And that's not just the legal profession, that's all professions. And I'll come back to that, mm-hmm. if I may.
Yes.
But in the late 80s, early 90s, the racism I encountered was just horrendous. You know, I would be treated absolutely appallingly by judges. And here's the thing, oftentimes it wasn't clients. You know, clients were happy to just have somebody represent them. So I never experienced any discrimination or racism from any of my clients in, you know, the 30 plus years that I've been practicing. It would either be other practitioners, and you know what? I remember. I'll give you one example. I remember being in court, and there was an opponent. I was doing it was a police action case I was doing, and there was an opponent who I thought I got on reasonably well with. I'd done many cases against him, but we were very respectful of each other, so I thought. And, so he was a well-known opponent of mine. And we were in court one afternoon, and we had to adjourn for lunch. So I was with solicitors, and we packed up our stuff to leave the courtroom, and I left, and my solicitor came out of court with me, and we left my opponent and his solicitors and his legal team. He was representing various police officers in court. And my sister had to go back in because she had forgotten her bag. And when she went back in, what she told me horrified me. She said that when she went back in, this barrister who I knew was impersonating me and making monkey noises. And she walked in on him doing that.
My goodness.
And he and his team were entirely shocked that they had been caught.
Wow.
So, you know, I say that I didn't encounter much racism to my face. Mm. Who knows what was happening behind my back. So that's one example. But one of the things that, you know, that those are opponents, like you take them as they come. They don't really bother me. You know, I do my fighting in court. But what's more significant and more impactful is the role of the judiciary. Yeah. And as a young black man and as a young black lawyer, the racism I encountered from the judiciary was terrible. I remember my very first case in court. I was doing it was an injunction against a client of mine on a family case. And it was a matrimonial dispute, and I was representing the father, and his wife had taken out an injunction against him in a domestic violence type case. And I remember going into court. I remember this was my, you know, they used to send junior lawyers on these, you know, sort of like domestic disputes where you try to get the husband back into the household or get an order for the husband to conceive the kids. So it's one of those typical family type disputes. I wasn't really a family practitioner, but it was the very first case that I had done, and I accepted it. I went into court and I introduced my client to the judge, who kind of grunted at me. And then I said, you know, I'm here representing Dad. And the judge exploded. Dad, you don't use that term in my court. I'm thinking to myself, what have I said? What have I said that's wrong? And he proceeded to berate me and screamed at me and went red in the face. And, you know, when I look back on it now, I went back to my chambers and I was told, well, you know, perhaps you should have used the expression father. Right? Yeah, I get that. But I'm telling you, the reaction was so extreme. And the way that this judge was conducting himself with me, myself and my opponent, who was white, the difference was noticeable, so noticeable. And, you know, maybe your listeners will be listening to this and say, well, you know, what's that got to do with your colour? You know, I know that the differential treatment that I received from this judge, there was much more to it than the fact that I had just used the expression, I'd called this father Dad.
Yeah, unbelievable. Gosh, such an extreme reaction. But you do give, we'll talk about your book now shortly, Leslie, and there are examples in your book that really just blew my mind in terms of, you know, that we don't really hear and we don't understand. And I think we're guilty of saying, well, you know, there's certain incidents, but the system itself just seemed to be intrinsically racist, you know, from in very many ways. And you do talk about instances that affected you and, of course, your clients as well when they appeared before the judiciary. But just looking at your book, which is really excellent, you've the title Do Right and Fear No One. I'm interested in finding out how you chose that title.
Well, the title is, I'm a member of Garden Court Chambers, and we've had for many years, I think it was Owen Davis, who was a former head of Chambers, chose that as our motto: do right and fear no one. And I just thought that just epitomizes the work and my life as a lawyer and as a barrister in the English bar. Mm-hmm. You know, you know, choosing to do right, choosing to do right isn't just the cases you choose. It's not just the fact that you're choosing progressive cases.
Sure.
But it's also the way that you conduct yourself when you do those cases and choosing to do so with integrity. Mm-hmm. And the fear no one, there have been so many times when I've been really fearful of going into court But, you know, when you're doing right for your client, you just have to put your fears behind you, even though you're taking on the might of the state, and just step up. Because oftentimes your clients, and I've been in many what I describe as David versus Goliath battles, is the little person who has to take on the might of the state. And often the only thing between your client and the might of the state protecting them is you. And your skill as a lawyer and trying to get what's right for them all to protect them. And there have been so many cases, Sarah, where I, you know, just take some of the deaths in custody, where you really are taking on the might of the state. Yeah. You're, you know, you're taking on so many different branches of the state, whether that be the police chiefs, home office, prison service, medical facilities, psychiatric hospitals. Sometimes, in one case, you have all of these bodies, all of these bodies, and all singing from the same hymn sheet against you and your client. And you just think the system is meant to be, you know, meant to have due process and meant to be inherently fair. But how can you say the system is fair when you've got the full arm of the state and all the resources behind the state against an individual or a small family who might not have the resources to take on the full arm of the state? And that's when you really do have to be fearless and step up to protect your clients.
Yeah, and some of, I mean, we'll talk about some of your cases in more detail. Your book covers a lot of the police action work that you did and taking on state authorities and all of those that you mentioned. But I must just say, you know, looking at your book, and you go through a number of the cases that you work on in great detail, but and just to mention some of them, Christopher Alder, the Birmingham Six, Grenfell, the deaths of Bobby, Christy and Bobby Shepherd as well, which really brought me back because I remembered hearing about the case loosely. But really, within those short, relatively short chapters, you really put, you know, the victim and their families really front and centre of that. You've spoken about taking on the Goliath, the wealth of the state against you. And I'm just wondering how you're able to, as one person, dedicate yourself so fully to those incredibly complex, difficult cases where you have even the media is against you. In very much of your cases, you reference how the media would have twisted arguments and really came down on your victims and family members like a ton of bricks. How do you manage to deal with that? And are you able to, it was one of the questions when I was looking at, just does Leslie ever switch off? Was he ever able to, you know, take a break and separate yourself from your work? Because you did have case after case after case, and many of them were high profile.
This job, this vocation, because it's more than a job, I suppose, takes its toll. And there have been times when I felt that I've been pushed so close to the edge that your sanity, it feels like it's being impacted. And there have been several times when that's happened to me where I've given my all and I've had no more to give. What they don't teach you at law school is you're not just a lawyer when you do these cases. You become so much more. You become a social worker. You become a counsellor. You become a therapist. Now, I don't have those skills. I've not been trained in those skills. But you need those skills in terms of, you know, dealing with grief, bereavement, pain of your client. And, you know, you do take on the trauma of your clients. You know, so some of the cases that you've mentioned you have been highly traumatic cases. So, you know, take the Birmingham Six. I did the second inquest in 2017, I believe, 2017, 2018, something like that. And where, you know, the families of the Birmingham pub bombings were trying to get to the truth as to who knew what, when, whether the police could have done more to prevent this atrocity occurring back in 1974. So you're dealing with real historic trauma going back a number of years,
yeah.
And you know some of the families are extremely angry and have that pain built up in them. That's just one example. Another example is I was involved and represented many of the Hillsborough families who died in the Hillsborough Stadium disaster. Again, you know, real, you know, a mass disaster, mass trauma. The Grenfell 5 disaster. So, you know, you cannot do these cases if you have any empathy and humanity and not be touched by the pain of your client.
Yeah.
So, to answer your question, does it impact me? Of course it does. Mm. How do I cope? Well, when I'm in a case, it's very difficult because one of my faults is I live, breathe, think, sleep the cases. What impact has that had on my life, my personal life? Well, you know, I've got a failed marriage behind me. And, you know, the reality is that if I think about my first marriage, one of the difficulties that I think is I devoted a lot of my time, too much of my time, on clients and away from home.
Yeah.
And that, if I'm being honest with myself, I think that played a significant part in my relationship failing. So, and that's me telling you warts and all,
yeah.
But the reality of it, I spend a lot of time now, right, a lot of time now I spend taking time out. I don't have a back-to-back cases like I used to. And one of the things that really eases my soul is music. I'm a saxophonist. Wow. So I play music, and that really, I'm a jazz saxophonist, and I just love jazz music and playing my saxophone, but you know that really eases myself. And I try to travel. I get away from the UK as much as I can. I don't like being recognised, and I'm finding increasingly I am being recognised, and that's simply because there aren't that many black King's Council,
yeah.
Around, so you do become known.
Yeah. Well, some of the cases that you have worked on, again, very high profile cases concerning, many of them concerning inquests into unlawful killings. Some of them you didn't, and the family members wouldn't have had the outcome that they perhaps wanted. And I mean, I think it's astonishing reading in your books, the family members of the victims themselves just seem to be, they've campaigned tirelessly even after they lost a case. And it's just so, you just look at these people and wonder, how did they muster up the energy to do this? But in some of your cases, even when it seemed like, and reading them, the odds were completely stacked against you, whether it was due to perceived failings within the system, the legal process, which we've spoken a little bit about, but also based on previous cases and previous experiences, in terms of, suppose I'm alluding more so to the police action cases and the deaths in custody as well. But how does it feel to win one of those cases? Because after you've won them, there have been changes within the system and incremental changes as well. But how does that feel, both personally and, I suppose, collectively, in terms of the law taking action based on what you've done?
Yeah, so elated, absolute joy for my clients. The fact that I might have played some tiny part in getting some accountability for them. But often when we've had a success in one of these cases, real sadness, because at the heart of every victory, particularly on these police cases, you have the sobering thought that this is as a result of somebody's life being taken unlawfully. And so you have to check yourself. You know, you have all this elation in the moment. Yeah. Sorry, that's my neighbor's dog.
That's okay.
You have this elation in the moment that there's been, you know, real success. Mm-hmm. And then you have that sobering thought, that really sobering thought that somebody died. Mm-hmm. And it's not just died, they died at the hands of the state. And perhaps the state has tried to cover up. Let me give you an example. I think one case that really comes to mind is the death of Sean Rigg. Mm. Sean died at the hands of Brixton police officers, I believe in something like 2008. We did the inquest in 2012. And so many cock-ups on the part of the state in the investigation, just botched, botched investigation. And one of the ways that the investigation was botched, now Sean was a young man who had a mental health crisis. You know, he was really unwell, on the street, you know, acting very bizarrely. Members of the public called the police, who came, restrained him, took him to Brixton Police Station. At Brixton Police Station, he dies, he collapses and dies. And the question is, how does a man, okay, he's got mental health problems, but otherwise very physically fit, how does a young man, or relatively young man, suddenly collapse and die at a police station? And what the police were saying in this case, and here's the thing, and this shows just how botched the official investigation was before the family got involved. They said, oh, well, we checked all the CCTV cameras and Sean was fine at the police station and his collapse was sudden and unexpected. And so one of the things that you would hope that the police watchdog, the Independent Police Complaints Commission at the time, now the IOPC, Independent Office of Police Conduct, one of the things that you would hope they would do is check the CCTV. Yeah. You know, you seize the CCTV at a police station and you just don't seize it. You watch it. Well, unfortunately, you know, the family fought for ages to get hold of the CCTV. When they eventually got it, they decided to crunch it themselves and watch the 15 different camera angles at the of the police CCTV, and what they saw shocked them, because it was absolutely apparent that the police watchdog had not watched the CCTV. And here's the reason why. The custody officer made it clear that he had gone and looked at Sean when Sean was in the police van. What the CCTV showed was the custody officer never left the police station. And despite the fact that he had said, Don checked on him, he was fine, he looked at me, I looked at him, and, you know, I had no concerns, it was absolutely clear that this custody officer had never left the police station and had lied about that. When that came out in the inquest, when the family discovered that themselves, and when that came out in the inquest, everybody was so shocked. The custody officer couldn't give an explanation. The CCTV spoke for itself. Yeah. It showed that he didn't leave the police station. And in the end, he was charged with perjury. Now, that only came about because the family decided to look at hours and hours and hours of CCTV evidence that the police watchdog didn't bother to look at.
My goodness. Unbelievable.
And And so you asked me how did you, obviously we felt really elated. We got a fantastic verdict or conclusion on Sean's case. It was great. But what's the family to think? You know, where is the accountability? The police watchdog aren't doing their job. They're not holding the police to account. And here's a young man that died when he should not have died in the most horrific circumstances.
Unbelievable. You do give some details of similar cases as well, and they're truly astonishing. But I will say, your book, although it focuses on the legal aspects, and you know, you look very often at coroners' inquests as well, and we get a taste and a flavour of the different types of coroners that you've worked with as well. But it's also a very much a personal coming-of-age book, so it's not just for lawyers. I mean, anybody would be interested in reading about your journey as well. But just to put the legal hat on a little bit, you've worked extensively on coroner's inquests, as I've said, before and after the Human Rights Act came into place in the late 90s, early 2000s. And just, I mean, legal aid funding is always an issue. It still is an absolute abomination when it comes to accessing justice. But Article 2, and it's been very important with cases here, we've had solicitors on talking about their legacy cases as well. I know it's formed a major part of some of your work. At the moment, we know that the Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, British Prime Minister, is talking about getting rid of ECHR, dropping out of it, having nothing to do with it again, using immigration the same way they did when they were arguing for Brexit. But, I mean, I suppose my first question is, how did the Human Rights Act improve the system when it comes to coroner's inquests? That's only one aspect of the law that it might have improved in terms of funding and in terms of, you know, people being able to access full disclosure, for example, which wasn't always the case before that was in place. And also, how important is it to ensure mechanisms like the ECHR remain intact? I think people kind of fluff over it a little bit, but really all of our rights are at risk if mechanisms like that are, you know, done away with by the government.
It's a really good question, and let me take it in turn. You see, I'm going to start with your last question first, because I think that's the fundamental question, and then I'll come and I'll explain how the Human Rights Act has impacted inquests. What we need to understand and have at the front of the mind, and what the government is trying to obscure with sleight of hand, is that the Human Rights Act is for everyone. You can't pick and choose the human rights that you like. You can't just have rights that you think are popular and ignore rights that may be unpopular. Rights are rights. And so what we need to bear in mind at all times is what might be unpopular today might be popular tomorrow and vice versa.
Yeah.
And so you really can't say, oh, we've got too many asylum seekers coming in, let's try to control our borders. And will take their rights away, because taking those rights away will have repercussions that you can't even think of that affect each and every one of us. And I think the government taking this populist view, very narrow-minded view on rights-based laws, is just appalling.
Yeah.
I'm speaking in the abstract. Let me just bring it down on a real level so people can understand, your listeners can understand how the Human Rights Act has really affected just ordinary people, people like you and I. Before 2000, before the Human Rights Act came into force, it's 1998, but it didn't come into force in the United Kingdom until October 2000, there was no legal aid, for example, for inquests. There was no right to disclosure at inquests. There was no level playing field. So you might lose a loved one, right, at the hands of the police. And remember, don't assume for one moment that your loved one has to be doing something wrong. Oftentimes, in many of the cases that I'm involved in, loved ones are doing nothing wrong. They are entirely innocent victims bystanders. Hillsborough, the people were entirely innocent football supporters, and it was botched, entirely botched policing that didn't manage the pens. And I know that there was all that defunct nonsense about it being Liverpool fans. It had nothing to do with Liverpool fans. It was to do with botched policing. Now, but for the Human Rights Act, there would have been no disclosure to those families. They would have had no right of legal aid. They would have had to have attended. Remember, the Hillsborough inquest lasted 2 years. Who can afford, what ordinary person can afford to instruct lawyers for 2 years unfunded? Whereas the state agencies, the police forces, the football stadiums, you know, all the Goliaths with big money, deep pockets, can afford to attend a 2 year long inquest to fight, get to the bottom. Those Hillsborough families, which ended up with an unlawful killing verdict, would never have had that justice but for the Human Rights Act leveling the playing field, allowing them to have proper representation. I remember before the Act, I used to go along to inquests with nothing but a piece of paper telling me who my clients were. Yeah. Didn't have any of the witness statements from the state, didn't have any of their documents, didn't have any of their notebooks, didn't have anything. And they would turn up with bundles of documents of all their notes, and I would be cross-examining or questioning the witnesses blind. That is what it was like before the Human Rights Act. And it's difficult to imagine, but that was only 20 years ago.
Yeah. Unbelievable. And you think of the lay litigants as well, who did, you know, take it upon themselves to act without any legal guidance, and they'd no access to funds, and maybe that's why they did it. It's an absolute, you know, failure on the part of the justice system. But yeah, well, here we are with the Prime Minister threatening to remove this from all of us, which is no big secret. This has been going on for some time. So hugely important that we emphasise the need to protect that mechanism for all of us. I'm just wondering as well about your cases, a lot of them concerning police brutality, and the details of which are absolutely astonishing, as well as the deaths in police custody in the UK. How did you feel when you heard about the news of George Floyd, which we know was viral across the world and still resonates with all of us who at that time, a difficult time as it was, considered that horrific case? How did that make you feel, just in terms of your clients that maybe you had been working with at that time and your past clients who suffered the exact same thing? We talk about positional asphyxia as one of the issues that you would have raised, that the police and those against you would have disputed. But there we have George Floyd filmed on camera, and everybody got to see what in fact happened.
I have mixed feelings about George Floyd's death, right? Firstly, it was the most horrendous death that you could watch, captured on CCTV, well, captured on a phone camera. Yeah, captured on a phone camera, showing this young man dying, pleading for his mother as he died, and as those police officers squeezed the life out of him. Absolutely horrendous. But, Sarah, to be honest with you, there was nothing new there for me. I know that for a lot of people, that was new and shocking. Mm. But that, for the past 30 years, has been many of the cases that I have been involved in.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, the way George Floyd died, I've done so many cases before 2020 when George Floyd died, where people have died in similar circumstances. Wayne Douglas, that was in 1996. Sean Rigg, 2012. Christopher Older in 1998. You know, all of these people died in similar circumstances. Wayne Douglas was recorded and reported to have been saying, "I can't breathe." Ibrahim Massey, who died, he was one of the first people who died from the use of tear spray in this country. He was saying, and was recorded as saying, "I can't breathe, I can't breathe." So nothing new. Kevin Clark, who died in 2016, in other words, four years before George Floyd, I did his inquest in 2020.
Yeah.
So after George Floyd, and on police body cam,
yeah.
Wayne Clark is recorded to be saying, "I can't breathe."
Yeah.
So these cases, you know, and this mode of death, positional asphyxia, and I should say this, positional asphyxia is a mode of death where somebody is placed inevitably on their front in the prone position, face down, and pressure is applied to their back, you know, either police officer's knee or holding them down, and it impacts the mechanical mechanisms of breathing, so you can't breathe,
yeah.
And they asphyxiate, essentially. That's the mode of death. That's all that positional asphyxia. You asphyxiate, but because of the position you're being held in. And that mode of death has been well known in the UK for years.
Yeah.
Ever since I've been doing these cases in the early 90s, mid-90s, we've had positional asphyxia. And so for it to become to the international conscience, it is a good thing, but it just makes me think, you know, I hear so many people saying to me, "Well, Leslie, we're not like America.
Yeah.
You know, we're not like the United States. We don't have those types of..." And I say to them, "Well, excuse me, I've made an entire career dealing with these cases."
Yeah.
And people can't... Do we have so many deaths in our country?
Yeah. I think you're so right.
Yes, we do.
Yeah, and it was only when I read the details of your case when it mentioned positional asphyxia, and you could see the defence is immediately, well, there's an underlying condition. That's why it happened, and that's why the person that was normally their kind of, you know, point of reference. But I kept thinking of the George Floyd case, even when I was reading them, and thinking, wow, this has been happening, as you said, you know, for years and probably still continues. The fact that it was filmed there, and it has given rise to a movement, the Black Lives Matter movement, and you would hope, as you said, that there is international attention on this issue. But of course, this has been going on. It's not confined to the US. Police brutality as well is not confined to the US, and you rightly so have witnessed that, and unfortunately many of your clients and their families. Just on that, do you feel the Black Lives Matter movement has made an impact? Or, I mean, it came at a time with Brexit.
Yeah, so my view about the Black Lives Matter movement is, firstly, it was I remember Black Lives Matter when it first started in 2016, 2017, but it really came to a fore in the what I describe as the COVID years, 2020, 2021, and it really made particularly our nation take a long, hard look at itself and racial injustice. So to that extent, I think it's been a really good thing, right? The way it picked up traction in 2020. So that's good. However, what worries me is I think there's been, you know, racial justice fatigue in the sense that, you know, do you remember all those really fantastic statements, public statements that corporations and individuals and bodies, you know, were making about being anti-racist, or what, you know, becoming anti-racist organizations, embracing the Black Lives Matter themes and everything.
Yeah.
Has a lot changed?
Yeah.
I don't think so. I think there has been a fatigue, and I think it's easy to say words.
Yeah.
What's more difficult is to produce action.
Yeah.
And I would like to see a lot more action, because I still think there's a lot of racial injustice, and there really still needs to be a greater leveling of the playing field.
Yeah, and we can see that really well, and it's really well highlighted as well in your submissions around the Grenfell Tower case, which of course we know happened on the 14th of June 2017, where 72 residents in a 24-storey residential block in Kensington, North Kensington, I think, lost their lives. And the beginning of your book, I find it really interesting that you set out a very grim situation for the Black community in England in the 1960s, 70s, in terms of tenancy and housing. Irish people have been included in that as well. in terms of there was basically, it was a free for all when it came to landlords, and they could charge whatever they want. People were evicted from their homes. It was just, it sounded like a horrendous place to be. And years later, decades later, you find yourself coming from knowing a system that was discriminatory and racist to the core. And decades later, you are appearing before the Grenfell Tower inquiry, stressing some parallel themes, race and state obligations. Again, the COVID-19 inquiry could fall into that as well. George Floyd, the issue around there that was brought up at that time as well. But why, I suppose it's an obvious question, but you mentioned fatigue there as well. And why is it so important in your submissions that the inquiry itself, and I suppose all types of inquiries, do not shy away from the issues of racism and the systemic inequality when considering the submissions before them? And I think the inquiry is still ongoing, but you really stress the need for the inquiry to consider that core issue as part of their entire consideration. Why is that still important to really stress that? And if there is to be any meaningful outcome of this matter?
Because you cannot ignore the elephant in the room. Mm. So if we take the Grenfell Tower inquiry, I don't think it's coincidental that in one of the most, one of the richest boroughs in the country, Kensington, that you've got a pocket where you've got a diverse group of people. You couldn't have a more diverse group of people than the Grenfell residents. When you look at the numbers and the statistics of the number of black and brown people who died, it's shocking. Mm. It's shocking that in, you know, in the 21st century, in one of the richest parts of the country, so many black and brown people died. Mm. I think that's the elephant in the room, and I don't think you can say that you're having an inquiry and not properly explore whether institutional racism played a part.
Yeah.
Now, okay, look into it. If you come to the conclusion it played no part, then so be it. But you just can't ignore it. Take the COVID inquiry, which I'm involved in. I'm representing currently a group of ethnic minority healthcare workers, doctors, nurses, social workers, you name it. If they work in the NHS or in the healthcare system. I'm representing a group called FEMHO, Federation of Ethnic Minority Healthcare Organizations.
Okay.
And one of the things that they make during the COVID years in 2020, the first 10 doctors to die were black. The first 10 doctors to die were black.
Gosh.
Now, the one thing we know, there's nothing about the physiology of, you know, being black which caused their death. We can eliminate that, and we know that because in other countries, particularly in countries which are predominantly black, you don't have the same statistics. Mm-hmm. Why is it in this country, which is a predominantly white country, that there you've got such a disproportionate number of black and brown people who died? And the answer is very simple. The answer is very straightforward. I appreciate the inquiry is still doing its job, but what we say is you had more black and brown people disproportionately on the front line being exposed to the virus. So there's no magic, there's no mystery to it.
Yeah.
You know, and many of my clients will say things like that, nurses, doctors, healthcare workers of colour were being put on the front line, or you had them disproportionately on the front line. That is what, so they had greater exposure to the virus.
Absolutely.
That is why they died. And the question is, why, given the fact that we had this unknown virus back in the end of 2019, beginning of 2020, when it was becoming very clear that this was a very dangerous virus, why were they're not sufficient protections being offered to those who are most at risk. Yeah. And those who are most at risk was disproportionately black and brown people. And the stats speak for themselves.
Absolutely.
So, but it's, for me, it's quite simple. It's the elephant in the room. And if you're having an inquiry and you want, and you're saying you're going to be looking at this, you cannot ignore the obvious.
Mm-hmm. Now, throughout your work as well, and some of those high-profile cases and the inquiries that you're working on, you have spoken about trespasser syndrome. And I'm wondering what you mean by that and how it affects you. You've been very open and candid about your personal life and how your work has impacted it. What do you mean by that?
So trespasser syndrome, well, most people will have heard the expression imposter syndrome, where, you know, you feel that, should I be here? I don't believe I belong here. You have to pinch yourself. You know, you get to a position in life and you can't quite believe that you are the right person to do that job. Mm. And to an extent, I felt like that often when I was in the, you know, halls of the inner temple, walking along the corridors of the, Supreme Court of Justice or whatever. You know, I see myself as a black working class boy who somehow made it into these into a really lofty profession. And then I realised, hang on a second, I'm not an imposter. I've got, you know, see, the problem about the expression imposter syndrome, and I'm not saying that there isn't a place for the expression imposter syndrome, some people genuinely feel like it, but there's a difference between imposter syndrome and trespasser syndrome. And the difference, when I coined the expression trespasser syndrome, I meant it in this way. Imagine you have a table that you're inviting people to sit around to have a meal, right? If you suffer from imposter syndrome, you feel that for some reason there's something wrong, implicit with you, that you don't have a right. I shouldn't be sitting at this table. I'm not worthy to sit at the table and break bread with you. But I realize that the problem is not with me. It's how I'm perceived, made to feel often in my journey at the bar. I've been made to feel that I'm a trespasser. That, you know, so the problem is not with me. The problem is with others and how they perceive me. They somehow see me as a trespasser that I don't have a right to sit down at the table with them and break bread. I prefer that definition because that is how I've been made to feel. And I find trespasser syndrome more empowering because I realize, no, the problem isn't with me. I don't have a problem. The problem is with you who don't want me at the table. So it's a way of empowering minoritized groups, whether that be women, people based on gender or religions or indeed race, to feel that you have a right to be at the table, you have a right to break bread, and don't make others feel that you don't belong, because the problem is not with you, the problem is with them.
Thank you for explaining that. I hadn't come across the term before, but I think it's so interesting. I suppose just leading on from that question, if anybody was interested in following your footsteps and getting into the line of work that you started off doing, would you recommend it? And what advice would you give?
It's a great career. It's a fantastic job. It's hard. Mm. It's not easy. If you want to go into rights-based law, protest law, you don't do it if you want to make a ton of money.
Certainly don't.
You know, if you want to make a ton of money, you go into commercial law. You stick to the corporate. So I would say, and I would say to anybody who's interested in doing it, it's such a rewarding career. I've had so much enjoyment from some of the results, but it's tough. How to go about, if anybody is interested, what should they do? There's a number of things you can do to position yourself to be more successful. Firstly, you need to show genuine interest. And so I'm often approached by lawyers young in their career, and they say, how do I go about it? I want to do the work you do. And I say, well, what have you done? How have you shown an interest? Because experience matters. Yes, you can have new shiny degrees and results, good results and good academics, but academics will only take you so far. To do this work, you really have to show a genuine interest. And what I say to people is, you've got to get involved. There are so many organizations, there's so many campaigns, there are so many people who need help, you know, volunteers. And if you say to me, oh, I haven't come across any groups or organizations, I say you haven't looked. Because you don't need to go to you don't need to go abroad, you don't need to go to the International Court of, Human Rights, you don't need to go to do death penalty work in the United States, you don't need to go to the ECHR in Europe, you don't need to do, you can do good work on your own doorstep. There's so many campaign groups in your own community that need help. You just need to open your eyes and look
for them. Absolutely, great advice. And on that, I guess the government, but the derogatory comments that we're all familiar with now from members of the British government.
Lefty lawyers.
Yeah, lefty lawyers, activist lawyers. We had a few on saying they were called fat cat lawyers, all the rest of it, doing this line of work. So the anti-lawyer rhetoric, I suppose, hasn't gone away. It still continues. Yeah. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on this vilification of lawyers. And it actually has led to real severe threats against lawyers for doing their job, human rights lawyers, immigration lawyers in particular. How concerned are you about that?
I am concerned about it because I think it's dangerous rhetoric. But let's face it, it's not new.
No.
In the 30s, fascist organizations were highly critical of lawyers. In the 40s, 50s, and even in, post-communist Russia, they attack lawyers. Lawyers are an easy target, and it's a real shame and pity that our government should embrace that rhetoric. But let's face it, they know what they're doing.
Yeah.
It's because lawyers who do the work that I do hold governments to account, and all governments, no matter what their complexion, do not like being held to account.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, this question, our final question that we ask most of our guests, doing the line of work that you do and similar other areas, activism and the law, do they go together? And is it important that you do work in the area that you work in, I guess, as a lawyer, but also, does activism feed into that in terms of making real change? I mean, it's hard to separate the two, and I'm just wondering what your thoughts are around the importance of the two or whether they are separate.
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't think they necessarily go together because I know many lawyers who do human rights work but who represent governments. And so it would be anti-human rights work or limiting human rights or restricting human rights, still human rights work, but from the other side. So it's not necessarily, you doing this work that you do it from a certain perspective. I think it matters. I think what I feel, what I believe, makes me a better lawyer. It certainly makes me a more passionate lawyer. Passion makes a very big difference in certain cases. So when I'm doing my police work, if I'm in front of a jury, let's say, on a police action, it makes all the difference in terms of results. The proof of the pudding is in the eating. And all I can say is, it's anecdotal for me, but I've got 30 years experience that says it makes a difference.
Wow. Well, Leslie Thomas, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us today. It's been fascinating to talk to you and fascinating to read your book. I hope your case in Antigua goes really well, and we look forward to following your work. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me. It's been a real pleasure speaking with you, Sarah.
Thanks everyone for joining me today. If you like the show, please remember to share and leave a review if you have a moment. And you can also check out our website, www.activistlawyer.com, where you will see some blog articles written by our guests and contributors, as well as some fabulous activist lawyer merchandise.
This podcast was recorded in Granite Podcast Studio. Interested in starting up your own podcast but don't know how? Granite Podcast Studio can help. Record your podcast in our state-of-the-art studio, which is based in the heart of Newry City. Our studio has cutting-edge and user-friendly technology and can seat up to 4 people. We also provide an editing service for our team, using your guidance and editing notes to provide you with a flawless finished product, leaving your listeners wanting more. For more information on how you can get started, visit www.granitepodcaststudio.com.